From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Government forces in Syria have denied chemical weapons inspectors access to the town of Douma. Inspectors with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons say they were kept from the town where a suspected chemical attack 10 days ago killed dozens of civilians and then prompted a U.S.-led missile strike over the weekend. Here with more is NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Michelle, Russian officials have said that these chemical weapons inspectors need an appropriate U.N. permit to visit the sites. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, what the Russians are saying is that the OPCW team didn't have the approval from the UN's Department for Security and Safety. And Russia's deputy UN ambassador says his country and Syria are ready to provide security for this mission. But we've seen a lot of finger pointing today. A UN spokesman has told me that the UN did provide the needed clearances for that team to go to Douma. And adding into all this mix, we've heard from the U.S. ambassador to the OPCW, Kenneth Ward. He's raising the possibility that Russia may have tampered with evidence at the scene already. And maybe that's why they're keeping this team from going.
And is there any evidence of that, that Russia has been on the ground there?
Well, the Russians did say they went to Douma. They did it soon after that reported chemical weapons attack. And they claimed at the time that they found no evidence of chemical weapons use. Of course, they later changed that story and accused Western-backed rebels of staging an attack to draw a military response.
Over the weekend, the U.S., the U.K., and France fired more than 100 missiles at three Syrian regime targets, and that was in retaliation for the apparent chemical attack of April 7th. They're blaming Syria's President Bashar al-Assad for the attack. Let's listen to U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, on Fox yesterday.
And so hopefully he's gotten the message. It was a pretty strong message. Not only did we go after their absolute strongest research facility, we went after their storage units where they hold the products, and we went after their production. So we put a heavy blow into their chemical weapons program, setting them back years.
Russian officials are disputing that. Do we know exactly what effect the missile strikes had?
Well, she claims that they obliterated, that was the word she used over the weekend as well at the UN Security Council, the chemical weapons research center that they hit. The Pentagon says that it did target and destroy the three places they wanted to target. And they deny Russia and Syria, Syrian claims that some of those missiles were shot down.
Is there something to the fact that the U.N. ambassador, Haley, said that there would be new sanctions against Russia as early as today, yet we have not heard anything as yet? Tell us what you are hearing there in Washington.
Well, it seems she was a bit far ahead on her skis, so to speak. We've seen no signs of new sanctions coming down today on either Russia or on Syria. The White House would only say that this was a quote that Sarah Sanders put out, that we're considering additional sanctions on Russia and a decision will be made in the near future. But just so you know, I mean, the Treasury Department is always looking at possible targets for sanctions. There's a whole office that does that. So it wouldn't be any surprise that they're looking at new sanctions. The question is, you know, why she would have she was very specific about saying that there are going to be sanctions today on these companies that are helping Syria's chemical weapons program.
And by the way, do we know, in terms of those sanctions, if they were to be implemented, what tie there is between those Russian companies and the chemical weapons program in Syria?
I certainly don't know. I mean, there's a lot of ties in general to between Russian companies and Syria. I mean, Russia, as you know, has been helping the Syrian government all along, both diplomatically at the United Nations, but also militarily with troops on the ground, with the Air Force there. So there's a lot of connections and a lot of business dealing, certainly.
France's President Emmanuel Macron said this weekend that France had convinced President Trump that it was necessary to stay in Syria long term. If that is true, that he convinced the president of that, have U.S. officials clarified just what that means?
No, in fact, they said something quite different. They said the Trump administration's goal in Syria remains the same, and that is to completely crush ISIS, that's a quote, and then withdraw U.S. forces as quickly as possible. I mean, the administration had been saying that it was going to stay there long enough to stabilize the areas controlled by ISIS. I visited Raqqa earlier this year, and the place is in ruins, so there's a lot of concern that if you leave quickly, ISIS could regroup. But, you know, President Trump just a couple of weeks ago was saying he wanted to pull troops out. So I think there's still a hot debate in the administration over what the strategy is. And then this whole Syria chemical weapons thing is separate from the counter ISIS campaign. There's a lot of complicated decisions to be made about Syria policy in the days and weeks ahead.
Thank you. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Well, now to the other big story out of Washington. Fallout continues over that explosive new book from former FBI Director James Comey. On Twitter today, President Trump accused Comey of lying to Congress and committing, quote, many crimes. This after Comey's exclusive interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos, where he said that the president is unfit for office.
I don't buy the stuff about him being mentally incompetent or early stages of dementia. He strikes me as a person of above average intelligence who's tracking conversations and knows what's going on. I don't think he's medically unfit to be president. I think he's morally unfit to be president.
Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us as he does most Mondays from New York. Hi, Derek. Welcome back.
Hello there.
So this was, in many ways, an extraordinary interview. I mean, Comey called the president a serial liar, said he was unfit. What are your main takeaways from the interview?
To be honest, I'm a little confused with what the White House is doing here. I mean, you want to smother a story like this in silence. You want to say, you know, this guy's bitter. The book has nothing new. We're busy conducting foreign affairs in Syria. And they've sort of taken the opposite approach. My takeaway from the interview is that James Comey has a story to tell. He has color to add to what we know. But the substance, the bones of this story have not changed much. You have a fired FBI director who does not hold the president in any sort of esteem, who considers his actions to be on the border of obstruction with justice, but has no smoking gun evidence that Trump has done anything wrong beyond that which we already knew. So in many ways, I think it is a remarkable, remarkable moment for an FBI, former FBI director, to be saying these sort of things about a sitting president. And that fact alone is sort of shocking. Hmm. But the substance of the interview, I didn't find particularly surprising.
Well, let's hear a little bit of reaction from the White House. This is White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway, who said the president was certainly aware of Comey's ABC interview, which aired last night.
His reaction is the same as it was when he saw excerpts earlier, which is, this is somebody who's not under oath in interviews and writing a book, and this is somebody who is giving a revisionist version of history. The president hardly knew the man.
Derek, to follow up more on the president's, you know, reaction, I mean, he's fired back on Twitter all weekend, calling Comey, quote, a slime ball and slippery. I mean, what do you make that they are in some ways adding fuel to this by responding to every Comey quote?
They absolutely are. And like I said, I don't really understand what they're doing here. You know, to be fair, you have a bit of smart White House play where they're essentially saying, you know, we want to smother this. We want to pretend that it's nothing doing. But look, the president spent all of last week and some of the weekend calling Comey a slime ball, which is perfect front page material. You know, we can assume, I think, quite reasonably, that Trump is not being paid by Random House to market James Comey's book. But let's be serious. If he were being paid to market James Comey's book, this is exactly what he would do. And in a weird way, he's making it clear to future authors who have Trump stories to tell that if they publish a book that says mean things about him, Trump will tweet free advertising all the live long day. Mm. This is not the signal you want to send. You know, Trump, the president, he's an attention steroid. Mm. Everything he touches gets a massive attention boost. And he has used that power in the last week, I think, in a less than helpful way.
And this is a publicist's dream in many ways. Let's go back to the interview a little bit. I mean, George Stephanopoulos of ABC asked Comey what he thought might happen if President Trump were to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is leading the probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible ties with the Trump campaign. Here's Comey.
It would, I hope, set off alarm bells that this is his most serious attack yet on the rule of law. And it would be something that our entire country, again, Democrats and Republicans, that is higher than all the normal fights about policy. That is about the values of this country and the rule of law. And it would be to the everlasting shame of partisans if they were unable to see that higher level and to protect it.
Derek, it's hard to overstate this. I mean, he's saying the president is a threat to the foundation of democracy, the rule of law. I mean, what does that kind of criticism mean for Trump, who has reportedly considered firing Mueller?
To be quite honest, I don't think it means anything for Trump. I think we have seen Trump withstand these sort of accusations over and over and over, and it hasn't seemed to change his behavior. The issue is not President Trump. The issue is, what will Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein do, and what will Republicans do to hold Trump accountable? You know, it's impossible to look at the last 15 months and think that any television interview is going to have behavioral modification effects on the president. It now falls to representatives, to senators, and to the people around Trump to make sure that we uphold the rule of law.
Derek Thompson, thank you. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Composer Leonard Bernstein would have turned 100 years old this year, and what a life. He's perhaps most famous for the groundbreaking and still searing 1957 musical West Side Story. It rocketed him to worldwide fame at age 39. A year later, the dashing conductor of the New York Philharmonic gave his first televised lectures on classical music, the wildly popular young people's concerts.
And we're going to listen to music that describes emotions, feelings, like pain, happiness, loneliness, anger, love. I guess most music is like that. And the better it is, the more it will make you feel those emotions that the composer felt when he was writing it.
We're going to take some time now to examine the Bernstein from a decade before that, the years right after World War II ended, and he wrote his second symphony called The Age of Anxiety. Our guest Fran Hoffner writes about classical music, and she says this piece in particular very much speaks to her. What was happening in the world when Leonard Bernstein wrote this beautiful symphony, his second symphony, in 1949?
Well, I think you see a lot of general confusion and disillusionment in the years following the Second World War, and no doubt that also played into a big part of Bernstein's life as he was trying to navigate his own career. You know, he moved a lot between conducting and composing, and maybe is perhaps best known for his film scores now, but was also trying to work within maybe a little bit more of a classical composer career narrative for a bit.
So the title he gave it is The Age of Anxiety. I don't know if he's talking about his own age, which was just 30 at the time, or the state of the world at the time. What do you think?
So he based it on a W.H. Auden poem of the same title. And that poem, I think, was extremely sort of reflective of modern anxieties of just young people living in cities. And Bernstein's friend sent him the poem and just thought, like, wrote him something along the lines of, I think you could do something really interesting with this piece of writing and translating it into music.
The poem is about four strangers who meet in a wartime bar in New York City. Kind of an unusual concept, though, for a symphony.
Yeah, and I think he sort of waffled between making it, you know, a ballet or an opera. There was so much that could be done with this general idea of four characters, and yet it comes together as this six-movement symphonic composition.
Let's listen to the second movement now. It's titled The Life of Man. There are seven variations, and there is this moment.
Thank you.
love this. What do you like in particular about that?
I like the playfulness of this little section here. I think it broadly shows, you know, a more optimistic view of childhood that quickly descends, I think, into a little bit of, like, angst and anxiety with teenage years. And I just love the way in which this movement in particular fluctuates.
So we're talking about, in the Seven Variations, various stages of life.
That's how I've always interpreted it.
The whole piece, as you suggest, is pretty dense. Six movements. The second one, as we said, has seven variations. The third movement is called the Seven Stages. The idea gets kind of exhausting, but let's listen to part of the third movement. Sounds a bit like a cityscape gone awry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the piano plays a really interesting role in this, in that the piece is for orchestra and solo piano. It's not a piano concerto by any means, so it almost puts the piano and the orchestra on equal footing. They're constantly in dialogue with each other.
And what keeps it from complete chaos of the city, as many cities are? What keeps it musically from that?
I think the balance and the constant back and forth between the piano and the orchestra. I see the piano as kind of the protagonist, and maybe the orchestra is the city and the times, if you will, and having those constantly be in dialogue and never letting one get too far away from the other is what keeps a very tense balance between them.
The fourth movement is called The Dirge, featuring solo piano. Let's hear it. Contemplative and then urgent.
Certainly. I think the most stressful movement in this to listen to.
How come?
There's something that puts me truly on edge just listening to this. I think it really creates a great sense of suspense about what comes next, and the percussion really comes to life in this movement.
Take a step back a little bit, Fran, and tell us more. I mean, we can appreciate the music ourselves. What do you find so relevant about this piece right now?
I like that it's a piece that's sort of constantly in transit. It's moving not only through time, but also through setting. And I don't think you have to know that it's based on a poem in order to appreciate the way in which it kind of carries you through a more abstract and confusing narrative. I think the emotions are really present and front-facing about the piece, and kind of just knowing the title, Age of Anxiety, brings it all to a head. And I also think it's a really just powerful work about youth and the unknown and this, like, really tenuous balance between suspense and anger and some real profound joy.
Yeah, when you talk about in transit, Bernstein himself was often in transit. He wrote that he worked on The Age of Anxiety in Taos, Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and Tel Aviv in planes, hotel lobbies. He was kind of moving all the time. You say the piece is the same way?
Yeah, and I like that he just always carried it with him.
You mean literally working on it?
Yeah, and like I think it's reflective of something that, you know, like an idea that sticks, that no matter where you are is kind of with you.
And if you think of all the movements as slices of life, this gets to a kind of interesting, entertaining slice of life. In the fifth movement, it's called The Mask.
Yeah, so this one is a little bit of a dance, and I also think it just foreshadows a bit of Bernstein's career. I think you can hear sort of elements that would eventually go into West Side Story or his On the Waterfront score. It's really playful and bright with little semi-sinister undertones to it. I love this movement. I get obsessed and listen to this one sort of over and over again.
You know, Bernstein wrote so many things that are whistleable or hummable. This is a symphony, so, you know, there are parts of it that I think people might recall or gravitate toward casually after hearing it. But you listen differently, and I wonder why you think that the piece itself made such an impact and still makes such an impact, you know, on somebody like you.
Well, I think what's great about this piece is it definitely has a lot of those very, what we now know as classic Bernstein refrains that do become hummable and memorable. But the broad darkness of the piece and how it feels kind of unknowable and how it ends on such an uncertain note, I think allows it to kind of transcend into something that sticks with you a little more. It is a little bit of a disturbing piece of music without being, you know, ugly or anything like that.
You mentioned the end of the piece. Let's listen.
Really like just sort of the dark undertones of it, and I think that's what makes it so powerful and resonate with audiences today.
So the music keeps building toward the end. Fran Hoffner, who writes about classical music, talking to us now about Leonard Bernstein's second symphony known as The Age of Anxiety. Thank you so much, Fran.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
If you haven't filed your taxes yet, you have until midnight tomorrow. But for people who are finished, the IRS reports that almost 80% are in line to get a refund. So what should you do with that money? Jill Schlesinger has some ideas. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Jill, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
First, we mentioned that stat. The IRS found that as of April 6, 80% of the people who filed were due a refund. That number seems a little high. How does that compare to other years?
It's about in line with other years. And it's amazing to me how many people just think this is money that falls from the sky. Of course, it is simply the return of the money that you basically lent to Uncle Sam for a year without getting any interest. So we'd like you to do something a little bit more, let's say, smart with that money than just leaving it there.
Right. It's your money. I mean, the average refund is around $2,900, the IRS says, almost $3,000. I mean, how should people invest that? You could put it towards a college fund, a vacation. You could have a heck of a party. You could pay down credit card debt. What's some of your thoughts on what people should do with their refund?
You know, I am a boring old certified financial planner. And CFPs, we have like this hit list of things where if you have money that's available, we want you to do. And of course, it's having an adequate emergency reserve fund kind of flows to the top. And that means 6 to 12 months worth of expenses in a safe, accessible account. And if you have that, maybe you want to pay down some old credit card debt or an auto loan. and even student loans. I mean, the student debt interest rate is running at around 6%. That is a pretty high number compared with how little you're earning on your checking and savings account. So I think emergency reserves, paying down debt, maybe even saving for a near-term expense, maybe if you have to write a tuition check, that's a good idea. I don't call a short-term expense like, oh my God, I have to buy the new iPhone. That's not there.
But do people follow that list? I mean, what, if anything, do we know, Jill, about, you know, what people actually do with their refunds? What are their priorities?
You know, a lot of people will save it, but I think that we might have gotten a bit of a clue in our March retail sales report that just came out this morning that a lot of people will go and spend it. And I hope that you can spend some of the money, but, you know, it's hard. It's delayed gratification, right? What do I want to do? Buy a toy for myself, or do I want to boost my retirement contributions or get a jump on my IRA funding or put money in that 529 plan? I sort of sound like an old school marm when I say to do those things that delay gratification when the alternative is to do something fun for yourself. So maybe take a few $100 and have some fun, but really try to use this money and deploy it in a way that's going to really help you achieve your financial goals.
Well, speaking of financial goals and people looking at retirement, I mean, big tax changes are coming for the next filing season. How is retirement planning affected by this big sweeping Republican tax cut that passed in December?
You know, retirement planning, it's in and of itself, is not actually so much impacted. We know that the limit has increased for 401k and 403b plans to $18,500. If you're over 50, you can add a catch-up contribution of $6,000. You still have your Roth and your IRAs. I think the biggest change is that for some people, your cash flow is actually improved this year because of change in withholding. And if that's the case, you might as well take that extra cash and get it to work, boost those contributions to your retirement plan. Use your tax savings wisely.
Put it into a college fund, not a flat screen. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
President Trump told Colorado Senator Cory Gardner on Friday that states should have the freedom to enforce marijuana laws. That contrasts with the Justice Department decision earlier this year. It gave prosecutors in the 9 states where marijuana is legal permission to pursue marijuana cases. Some of this regulatory uncertainty has put a crimp on a growing industry, one that's attracting big money. A business called Green Table links marijuana entrepreneurs with investors. Bill Marcus is partner at Green Table. He stopped by our studio to speak with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd.
Bill, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, Peter.
How big is the pot industry today? How much money are we talking about?
Well, we're talking last year, I believe, close to $7 billion. And the growth rate is about 29% a year. It's an absolutely amazing growth rate. You know, it's one of the fastest growing industries in America.
So your idea is to then put investors into the same room as entrepreneurs, let them have dinner together, see if they can strike a deal. What kind of traction are you getting?
We're getting great traction. We only launched a year ago. We do it at beautiful locations or in states that are having critical opportunities, like, for example, July recreational here in Mass. That's what's attracted us here. We have institutional backgrounds in terms of capital markets. My partner, Greg Schreiber, and I have been working in capital markets our whole careers.
So, in other words, you guys are Wall Street guys.
We're Wall Street guys. That's right. And we noticed that there was an opportunity in the cannabis marketplace in terms of capital raising at the highest end, at the premium level, where people who have big checks to write, and we're talking about private equity funds, ultra-high net worth individuals, they are mostly – some of them are trying to avoid the press because there's still – at the federal level, this is an illegal substance. But many of them are getting involved across state lines, within state, and internationally.
Well, we're going to talk about the challenges that you face because of the fact that it is still illegal under federal law. But I just want to stick on this idea, and I hope this doesn't offend you, but you look like a Wall Street guy. You know, you don't look like I don't know if you smoke pot or not, but you don't look like it. You're wearing a nice jacket. You're trying to make the point that this is mainstream.
Yeah, I think that is exactly right because it is coming mainstream. And in a lot of circles, especially in financial markets now, It's a question of when, not if. And that's overwhelmingly reflected in the way Americans are being polled. And the dollars, the large dollars we're seeing, for example, in private equity, which is strictly related to cannabis, they started out with $5 and $10 million funds. We're now seeing $50 and $100 million funds just a year later coming to market. And that money is being doled out into larger and larger pieces, $5 and $10 million investments regularly. The biggest client we took on for a capital raise last year was raising $120 million.
So let's talk about where some of that money is going. Is this money going to help get a grow operation off the ground? Is it going to invest in new technology that entrepreneurs are trying to find some money for? What are we talking about here? Is it high end? Is it low end? Is it across the board?
You know, it's in our neck of the woods. It's mostly our purvey. It's across the board, but mostly high end. And that means, for example, genomics. You know, one of the speakers we have from Oregon, they are one of the leading companies that is taking the genomes of the different seeds, categorizing them almost like a Library of Congress to see which are the hardiest seeds, which ones show the most promise with Alzheimer's and schizophrenia and testing. And so these are scientists. So you have biosciences, and we also have multi-state cultivation operations where they're doing organic, where they're putting their footprint across all of their plants so there's consistency in dosing. We have packaging companies that are going public, not just in Canada but also in the United States, that are raising money just for branding and marketing, because at the end of the day, this is becoming a consumer product, just like your mainstream detergents and laundries and cereals. This is going to be something that's going to become a mainstream consumer product in the next several years.
It does look like it is slowly going that way. However, you said it, the federal government is not yet on board with this project of legalized marijuana. You have an attorney general who has repealed Obama-era policies that would encourage prosecutors to look the other way. I mean, why would an investor want to get involved right now with so much uncertainty around federal law?
That's a very good question, Peter. I mean, we can tell you that the result is that they are. And I think it's because, you know, there's always the risk-reward opportunity, right? So while there's a gray area, while we were lucky that the Cole memo was just extended now till September, and that's
the Obama-era policy.
Correct.
Yep.
While you've got these higher risks, the rewards of that, the payoff on those risks, is worthwhile in investors' minds.
But are you saying to me that investors don't have cold feet even a little bit when they hear the top law enforcement official of the United States making such an argument?
Fair enough, and that's correct. Some investors that are, let's call it Wild West, very interested in all types of operations, touching the plant or not touching the plant. And that's one of the categories, you know, ancillary businesses that don't actually touch the plant where, you know, then you're getting into the federal territory.
Mm-hmm. Or, like what? Be specific there.
Growers, cultivators, dispensaries that are selling, all right? Those are touching the plant. Those are riskier businesses from the standpoint that you're talking the feds could come in, change rules, decide to prosecute. And so far, they've been hands off for the most part. Then there's the ancillary businesses. For example, the bottling or the labeling or the marketing. Those businesses are wishing a lot more appetite for because there's no risk of the feds coming in. Now, technically, the way that I understand it, and I'm not an expert, okay, we're involved in the capital raising business, but technically, if the money that's being used to pay for this touches the plant, there's a trail there that could invite prosecution, but it has not happened yet.
There is another red flag that I would have if I were a big investor putting my money on the line, is that why would I be interested in putting money into an industry that is so highly regulated, inconsistently regulated from state to state, and is subject in some cases to double-digit taxes? I mean, why does that make sense?
Because the returns are there. And that doesn't mean all of these operations are going to survive. You know, we're at the early stages still, obviously, in this industry, where even the cultivators and the dispensaries that are making money hand over fist right now have huge tax bills that they've got to have collected. And then there's price compression that is occurring with natural competition. This is particularly starting now in obviously Colorado and California. Between Colorado, California, and Washington, you have almost 56% of the North America business last year in those three states. And you're starting to see that price competition. So you're going to have weeding out. But there's still a huge amount of money being made in this industry, and it's evolving. And in some of those places, you have state banking and you have credit unions.
To get around the federal rules that don't allow marijuana money to go into a
bank.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's another whole area that we see a lot of investment concerns. But there's some of our key investors are trying to find a solution to that, you know, and invest in that because it's another opportunity. The banks that can eventually open up and take cannabis dollars are going to be very successful. They have a natural flow.
There is a story out of the Sacramento Bee that is reporting California's pot revenue so far 50% lower than projected for commercial marijuana. And, of course, the state just had retail shops open up in January. Why would that be? A concern to you?
It's not a concern to us because the investors that we work with are very sharp. They're very shrewd. They don't just throw money around. You know, these are very pedigreed individuals and institutions that know how to look at the risks like that, and they're factoring in those price compressions and maybe slower than anticipated growth rates. So, you know, that's one of the things that differentiates our company is we work with very smart investors, and we put premium opportunities in front of them. So if we have a dinner with four companies presenting, we know that if we don't put something in front of them of quality, we'll lose their interest to get these investors who are flying in from all over the world. So they are very smart guys, and they know how to recognize those values and risks. They've been doing this for years. They're not newbies.
That's Bill Marcus, a partner at Green Table at the networking business for the legal marijuana industry. Bill, thank you.
Peter, pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bill Marcus was speaking there with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd. Let us know if you think marijuana is a good investment. Tell us at hereandnow.org.
If you're a high school senior planning to go to college in the fall, this time of year, you're probably checking your mailbox or email to see where you might have gotten into college. But if you live in California and you want to stay close to home, you might be among the many students who may be disappointed. State universities there are turning away thousands of eligible students. Enter nearby out-of-state schools that are opening their doors. Vanessa Roncagno from member station KQED explains what's going on.
Danny Holton was a good student in high school. He was in AP classes, he was in the environmental club, in the homecoming court, and athlete of the year. Holton had a 3.85 GPA. It wasn't the 4.6 some of his classmates had, but still, he felt good about his college prospects.
Why would you not want me on your campus? Like, I just lift people up, I get good grades, I'm interested in school, like, I'm involved.
Holton had his eye on the UCs, the University of California, at Davis, San Diego, and Irvine. But his number one school was a state university, Cal Poly. He loved how friendly people were there. He was excited to turn in his applications.
You know, my whole high school career, it kind of led up to this point, you know, getting the acceptance letters from Cal Poly and UCs.
Then the letters started coming in.
And I was rejected. They just kept coming. It was like the same letter, you know, San Diego, Davis, Irvine.
Cal Poly didn't let him in either.
No wait list. It felt like I wasn't even close.
So many California students have shared that disappointment recently. As the state's population grows and increasing numbers of high school grads meet college eligibility requirements, more and more qualified CSU and UC applicants have to compete for limited space.
When you see your kid up at midnight doing papers for AP and really working hard, yeah, you kind of would like all that extra work to pay off in some way.
That's Danny's dad, John.
Even if you do everything right, you still can't get into the UCs.
So we just don't have enough seats. That's a big problem.
Londe Ajose runs California Competes, an organization that advocates for higher ed policies that increase access. Last year, the CSU system turned away over 30,000 eligible students, and UC turned more than 10,000 eligible applicants away from their schools of choice, instead referring them to the only campus with space, UC Merced. Only about 100 of those said they planned to enroll. At a speech in March, marking the University of California system's 150th anniversary, UC President Janet Napolitano called for public investment to meet the growing demand and fulfill the state's original mission.
At the time of the university's establishment in 1868, no other institution resembled what early Californians had in mind for their university. A top-notch higher education institution accessible to all who qualify academically, regardless of their income or their background.
As Danny Holton's rejection letters piled up, he was grateful for his backup plan. His college counselor had urged him to apply to a few out-of-state schools, and the news from outside California was better.
When I got my acceptance from ASU, that was awesome. Then I got a letter from the dean with like a certificate with my name on it saying, like, hey, welcome to ASU.
Not only did Arizona State University welcome Holton, they offered him a lot of money, $54,000, or about half his tuition for 4 years. Holton and his family figured ASU would end up costing less than a California school. It's a calculation growing numbers of California families are making. Since 2002, Arizona State University has seen a more than 200% increase in California student enrollment. According to the U.S. Department of Education, in 2014, more than 36,000 California freshmen enrolled at out-of-state schools. Here's Londe Ajose from California Competes again.
Those are bright and talented students. Those are students whose families are here in this state. Those are students who then may or may not return home.
Holton is happy he's at ASU. He has another 2 years of college to decide what he'll do next. But the longer he stays in Arizona, the harder it gets to leave.
I just have the connections here. Like, this is where I am now. I'd call it my home.
If young people like Danny don't come back to California, policy experts predict there will be a problem. By 2030, an estimated 40% of jobs in the state will require at least a bachelor's degree. And California's not turning out nearly enough. Ajose says it's not just about the economy. College grads are more likely to be civically engaged.
But it also matters for the kinds of communities we want to live in.
UC President Janet Napolitano is calling on chancellors to graduate more students in 4 years, clearing the way for new students, and advocating for a policy that would guarantee admission to qualified community college transfer students. Meanwhile, CSU trustees approved policy changes to redirect eligible applicants to campuses with space instead of rejecting them outright. They're all efforts to push California to live up to its promise of access that helped make one of the greatest higher ed systems in the world. For Here and Now, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
And Vanessa's story comes to us from a nonprofit media collaboration, California Dream. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.